I would sometimes go work weekends. My boss would pull me up and ask me, you know, why did you even come to the weekend? Because I have to explain my boss what your team member is doing here on a weekend, right? So I think focus on culture and DNA from day one. Rajneesh and I used to interview every single person we hired, and we still do it till date. So one of the founders will still take the last round. No matter how big we've become, we are more than 500 people now, but it might slow down the hiring a bit. Times when you have zero revenue and no visibility on the future, if your team is still together and saying, we'll get ourselves out of this, right? You know that it's very hard to for anything to then kind of kill you. Doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and today I have with me a very, very special guest. Today I'm hosting a founder who's been in the ecosystem for the last 15, 16 years and has built one of India's most enduring companies. Join me in welcoming Alok Bajpai, the co-founder and CEO of Ixigo. Thank you so much, Alok, for joining me. Absolutely honored to be hosting you today.
Thank you so much for having me here, Jibraj.
Glad to hear that, Alok. And I think I'm so excited for this conversation because there's such a large realm of things you've seen and done over the past almost two decades now. It feels like, you know, 15, 16 years to say feels of such gravitas. I can only imagine what you've been through. But as we cover the next 60 odd minutes, I think two, three themes come to mind. One is building this enduring institution, as they say, right? Enduring in itself is a very heavy word to stand by. And you've proven year on year that this is possible. Second is this theme around survival in a market which is evidently going bad, and there's a lot of chatter around funding winter, all of that. You've really survived and built your own pathway and roadmap. And the third being the strong fundamentals with which you've created a company, right? We want to cover all of that, but I want to start off with that first point, right? And I was telling you before the conversation started, you mentioned that you left your job in 2006-07 because you felt underutilized and you were feeling like you could do more with what you already had. You were in debt. You didn't know what would make out of it. Startups were not the in thing, but you still made it happen. Take us back to that time. Talk to us about your ideology and looking back, what does that feel like?
Yeah, so, if we roll back to 2006, right, when actually I had just finished business school a few months prior to that. I actually sat through a lot of consulting and banking kind of interviews, didn't make through any of them. The feedback I used to get was that I can't think straight. And that led me to going back and doing some soul searching, right? What am I really cut out for? And one of the things I realized was that I had this passion to come up with new things, right? And it manifested itself in many ways. Always was thinking out of the box, even in my engineering school days, at work, you know. So I was not the typical 9-to-5 kind of job guy ever, right? And for me to think of moving back to India was also a big decision because I'd worked abroad. So I graduated from IIT 2001, worked in Europe for about 4.5 years, did my B school outside India as well, INSEAD, and then towards the end of B school is when my soul searching started. And at that moment, two things really helped me make up my mind. One was I'd watched this movie called Swadesh, which all of us have watched, and got inspired by Mohan lighting up the bulb back home, wanted to therefore move back to India. And I think you opened the newspaper those days, you know, even today, everyone talks about India and China, right? And then you realize that the economy you're sitting in is growing at 0.2% or, you know, if growing at all. And therefore, the desire to move back to India, do something of my own came from that. And Steve Jobs had this commencement speech at Stanford in 2005, right? Which again, was very inspiring, right? Which was about connecting the dots, right? So that led me to start connecting the dots. So I was like, I'm in travel tech. That's where I'd worked for the last 4.5 years. I have some B school knowledge now, and I want to move back to India, right? The moment I started connecting these dots, I was like, okay, I need to go back to India and do something in travel tech. That's how it all originated. And I had to obviously get a team around that as well. So my co-founder was going through his own soul searching journey, had a similar background as me, and you know, and both of us just decided one day to take this call of coming back to Gurgaon and actually doing something about travel in India. So that's how it started.
Well, that's lovely. I think very interesting to note the sort of maturity. Do you think it steps back to the fact that, you know, you'd gone to some good institutions, great institutions, where you could look back and develop that kind of insight that you had to do something more with your life and something unconventional than follow the standard trajectory?
I think some of it had to do with frustration, right? Which is, you know, if I recall some incidents, right? We used to work for a French company, right? A European company, which typically works like 35 hours a week, and people head home at 5:30 p.m., right? But as a young engineer who has joined, you know, you have the passion to do more, right? And to show that you're capable of doing more. And I would sometimes go work weekends. My boss would pull me up and ask me, you know, why did you even come to the weekend? Because I have to explain my boss what your team member is doing here on a weekend, right? So I think got frustrated about not being able to do more than what I believe I was capable of. And then there was this feeling of rejection, right? Like at the end of B school, you feel you've made it, right? But there are some companies which come and say, no, you're not good enough, right? And I think this combination leads you to go down a path where you say, okay, where can I maximize the full potential of what I'm capable of doing? And the natural answer is entrepreneurship, right? Because it really tests every aspect of your personality, right? So it's a grind I don't recommend to everyone, but it's a grind which can make or break you, right?
Yeah. No, that's phenomenal. Great. I think that makes a lot of sense. Coming to the point around survival, right? Like now that we've understood what the early steps look like, it's been 15, 16 years, and looking at least from the outside, why I keep mentioning that is because just in terms of pure time span, that looks like a significant time spent. As a team, as a founder who's working towards this broad vision, and that's not changed since day one, how do you ensure that you maintain this space between, you know, what aspirationally looks like success vis-a-vis what survival can mean for success? If you can maybe clarify from your understanding and how you've developed learnings around this concept through the years, that'll be very helpful.
So I think, you know, building an enduring company comes from a few mindful actions that, you know, you take as founders and as a team, which you only discover in hindsight, right? It's not like if you'd asked me the day I started that, you know, I'd be doing this 16 years out and we would still be growing this fast. It would have been very hard to say that because, like you said, we started out in debt. We had very little visibility. We had almost no funding. Like our Series A round happened 5 years after we started, right? So I think... I would think about the motivation behind why a founder is actually doing what they're doing, right? If the motivation is related to monetary gains or let's say getting something quickly, right? I think the chances of building something enduring diminish a lot, right? Because the motivations have to stem from the fact that the journey may be hard, but you want to build something that delivers value for the customer or for the user in your space. And that value creation is an iterative process. It doesn't happen overnight, right? And I think the best products in the world have been built, you know, over a span of time where they've launched, they've iterated, they've discovered things that don't work, they've reinvented themselves and, you know, come out with something that was even better. And over time, rinse and repeat this process, right? And it has been the same for us. So the Ixigo you see today looks very different from the Ixigo we launched with. But there are a few things that have changed and there are a few things that have not changed at all, right? And the things that have not changed are what make you enduring. So three things which I believe helped us is number one, our focus on culture and DNA from day one. Rajneesh and I used to interview every single person we hired. And we still do it till date. So one of us, one of the founders, will still take the last round. No matter how big we've become, we are more than 500 people now, but and it might slow down the hiring a bit. But the cost of making a cultural mistake in hiring is very high, right? And similarly, I think when it comes to tough decisions at a time when somebody's not a cultural fit, or in tough times, if somebody's not resilient enough, is he the right person or is she the right person in the team? I think taking those tough calls also in a timely manner is very important. So I think we've been very conscious about who we hire, how we, how our actions during tough times define the culture of the company, and and how does that translate into culture through our actions. We don't have culture posters on our wall, by the way. We've come from a school of thought where we say the actions of the founders, the leadership team, seep down and become culture, right? That's what culture is all about. And I think that's been constant from day one, right? We just agreed on day one that, we will be transparent. We will be treating people just like we treat, our friends and family, right? And that's what we expect from them in return. So I think that was number one. Number two is, how do you measure success, right? Because we get carried away by various definitions of success. Is it valuation? Is it number of users? Is it revenue? Is it, and I think for us, success has always been about pleasing our customers, right? So if somebody writes into us, gives us a 5-star review on the Play Store and, writes 3 lines, we actually post it to everyone in our group and feel very proud about it, because that small praise from a customer means a lot, right? Yeah. If you get enough of that, the rest of the things will follow. Okay. But to earn that, you need to work very hard on product and, customer experience. So I think that definition of success hasn't changed again from day one, saying if customers love what we do, then we are winning. Everything else doesn't matter. I mean, everything else catches up over time, right? So that's number two, which hasn't changed from day one. Till date, you will see that even the founders at Ixigo are active in responding to customers, because we believe that's the reason why we exist, right? Like, yeah. Somebody tweets to me as a customer with a problem, I will respond to them, right? It's a promise, and I keep that promise every single day. The third thing is, how do you handle the worst of times, right? And that, in our case, we've seen enough of them. We've actually seen at least 4 times in our journey where we ran out of cash and we didn't know how to pay the salaries the next month. The first time was back in 2008, the global financial crisis. Then we had a couple of times when our funding rounds weren't closing on time. And then, we had a situation in COVID where we didn't know what would happen, right? And in all these things, the way we dealt with the situation has become like a template we follow now, which is communicate transparently. Let everyone in your team know exactly how bad, the situation is. And discuss even things like how much runway we have very openly. And ask the team to help you solve it. Because remember that, whatever you do will have an impact on the team, right? Mm-hmm. And if the team has a solution that you haven't thought of, that might be the best solution, because they will be motivated to actually deliver that, right?
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of been very empathetic in these situations where the team has come together, gotten us out of these situations in a beautiful way, and we'll talk more about it. And that's where, the downside protection really comes from, because if in the worst of times, when you have zero revenue and no visibility on the future, if your team is still together and saying, we'll get ourselves out of this, right? You know that it's very hard to for anything to then kind of kill you. So, and what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Absolutely. Wow, that's brilliant, Aluk. I think so many important pointers there. All three of them at the end, right, highlight what enduring companies are built out of. As you were speaking, I realized that this last part and, around what success means for founders, what original motivations also should mean. And especially considering in your journey, there was a lot of lack of external validation, right? So rejections become the way that you might feel unaccepted, and things like this have not been spoken of enough in the ecosystem also, right? So if you had to highlight some of this, right, like what should success ideally mean for a founder, and how do you then navigate any external criticism, rejection, or lack of validation? How do you marry the two, and how do you continue irrespective?
Right.
Now will be very interesting to note.
Yeah, so I think we've seen so much rejection that can talk hours about it. But, you know, I think as a founder, you're so passionate about your idea that anyone even criticizing it, rejecting it, you know, leads to a lot of heartburn, depression, etc. Right? I remember, give you some small anecdotes, right? It was very early days. We were trying to raise our first round. I went to Bangalore, met a VC there, won't name them, and was trying to raise like $500,000 to $1 million for the seed round. And the person actually, after the end of the pitch, tells us that they don't believe that we can even raise $100,000 on this idea. And given we are not the first one in this space, we, you know, it's unproven. And we were building Metasearch. At that time, there were 4 funded OTAs already. And, you know, I still remember I came back to my room and I was in tears, right? Because it's like somebody telling you that you're wasting your time, right? Like with whatever you're doing. Yeah. Because, you know, you hold that idea so close to your heart, it hurts you. But in hindsight, you know, I think those things don't really matter, right? Because what matters is your belief in your idea so strong that you can go and execute come what may. And the only validation, again, is why were you doing it? Go back to that question, right? And we went back and saw customers were loving it. We had user base growing organically month on month, right? There was no reason to feel bad about anything. Yes, we had a funding gap, right, etc. But we found ways to solve it. Founders went without salaries for many months, right? And as long as you can make those sacrifices, you can come out of those situations, right? But fundamentally, what you need to continue believing in is why you're doing what you're doing. Is that working or not, right? Just because someone comes and tells you, I cannot fund you, or I don't believe in your idea, or you won't be able to raise money, you know, doesn't mean anything, actually, because you can always go back and prove them wrong. You look at the most successful companies out there, the best of investors actually rejected them, right? And some investors now have this anti-portfolio on their website saying, these are the companies we missed, right? You want to be there. And that's what we told ourselves, that, you know, we want to prove this person wrong in a few years. Let's go back with that attitude. So I think that's how you need to handle rejection, because otherwise it can be very depressing.
Yeah. In the moment when some of these things happen, right, what is the thought process that keeps you going? Is it more like we'll figure it out along the way, or are things going well? But what is it in that moment that keeps you going and not give up?
I think the fact that you continue to see traction, right? And if you have real product market fit in certain areas, you continue to see organic growth coming in. I think that's defensible, right? That over time you can figure out ways to, you know, build monetization engines around it and capture that value. But that value creation is real. When you build something people like, when people start coming, flocking to it, when they tell others about it, you see organic growth coming in. We've seen this multiple times, right? Like we launched this application back in 2013 for train users, which was one of the first few train-related applications on Play Store. And it was built out of a hackathon, right? The only thing we were trying to solve was people used to go to the Indian Railway website and look whether their PNR confirmed or not. And we said, can't we just automate this whole thing, right? And pick up the PNR from SMS inbox, automatically check the status and let the user know if it's confirmed or not. And small use case, got like 1 million downloads in probably in a few months, right? And all organic, right? Like you discover use cases like that that people like, you will figure out over time, you know, how to monetize it. And today we are the largest OTA when it comes to train ticket sales. Back in the days, we were just a utility app, right? So in hindsight, one could have said this is not working because we're not making any money on it.
Yeah.
But the real metric you have to see is, do people like to use your service or product? Is the liking on a scale of 1 to 10 at a level where people would recommend others to come and use it? If you've cracked that, irrespective of whether an investor likes it or somebody in the team criticizes it, you know, it's working, right? Like, but that's very hard to do. That's the harder problem to solve.
Got it. No, very interesting. I think this has been very fascinating to note, especially when it comes to survival as a theme and just building long-term companies. Why don't we take a different segue and understand more around customer experience, right? I think travel is a category, and I could be wrong, please correct me if I am, but travel as a category feels like something that's very influential to a customer's lives, right? It's very experience-led. If it goes wrong, there are emotions attached to it.
Yeah.
There are end consumers who are, you know, putting, say, there can be emergency situations on the line, whatnot, right? Talk to us about how have you observed customer experience grow as a part of your journey in terms of building Ixigo, and what are learnings around the customer base that you serve, and how have you iterated on top to provide that, you know, I think Airbnb puts it like that 6-star experience.
No, I think you're bang on. Like, travel is one of those categories where a lot of emotions are connected to it, right? Like, when you plan a trip, there's excitement around that. You're going with your friends or your family or your girlfriend or, you know, whoever you're traveling with. The point is, that trip will bring you closer. It will allow you to have undivided attention, which you don't have in your day-to-day life. And it's one of the few things you spend on that actually make you richer, right? So the unfortunate reality is that because historically travel was one of those categories where, you know, and especially in the offline world, right? Like, people could sell once to you and disappear because the frequency is not high. You might plan one trip a year. Certain people might do only 4 trips a year, etc. The amount of attention required on post-booking experience or in-trip experience was never very high, right? Because historically, whether it was travel agents or OTAs, they were just very focused on selling tickets to you, right? Booking things for you, because that's where they made money. I think, whereas fundamentally, travel may, there are broken, you know, experiences, micro moments where you have anxiety right from the time when you're planning to, you know, when you've booked and you now you're in that mode where you're traveling, because there are many things that can go wrong, that many small pieces of information that are missing, and you start panicking about it at the last moment. When you reach that place, you know, certain things might not be as per plan. Things change at the last minute. So in reality, what happens is that you, that perfect trip in your mind, which you had, becomes several moments of panic attacks and anxiety. And that was actually one of the insights when we started our company. The insight we had was that if we can solve for moments of anxiety that lie outside the booking moment, because that's a very small moment of time where you actually pay for the ticket and get the e-ticket in your inbox. The moments of anxiety exist before and after, right? And if you look at our evolution and journey, we are one of the few companies in this space which focused on utility as the core, whether it was for flight metasearch giving you comparisons and information on where to book your flight ticket, that's how we started the flight side, or on train, where we started by things like PNR status, running status, you know, finding your seat in the coach or where your coach will be, which platform your train will come on, you know, basic informational use cases. But the reason why those things took off is because nobody else was focusing on those, right? Like, and but those were real problems worth solving because consumers cared about them. Once we had scale, we started selling tickets, but we already had the trust built by solving for information where we couldn't monetize much. But but the trust is more valuable, right? Once you have the trust, I think monetization is easier. So I think the way we approached the space was very different that way. When once you look at the journeys of other players and ours. You know, that's the biggest fundamental difference, that we care about what happens to you before you book and after you book. Yeah. And we spend a lot of time improving that.
Absolutely. I can only imagine. I think that shows, as you were speaking, right, it showed that you require a lot of trust in this system as well, right? Like the customer needs to trust you. And you've always spoken about how there is very little usage of inorganic marketing vis-a-vis organic marketing. Also a factor of, you know, not having as much capital to burn and building a very strong fundamental company. Talk to us about how you think about trust when building in this category, and how does some components, I know content marketing, but what are other components that you've leveraged to establish that trust with the customer?
See, I think the best marketing is actually product. Mm-hmm. We've been strong believers of that school of thought, that if you have a strong product, it markets itself. Mm-hmm. And I think the second best way to market is creating some hooks that allow you to build virality or reasons for people to tell each other about the product. Because, no matter how good your product is, if you can make it simpler to for people to communicate and tell others about it, or if you can build content that can tell people about your product in a way that's not an ad, because people are sick of seeing ads, right? Both online and offline. But people love great content, right? And they share great content. So I think the insight for us was, if we can build a great product and build great content around it that helps market the product, then we can do it without also burning a lot of money, because spending money to market on TV and print, etc., is very expensive. We never had the capital till a few years back. We didn't really have the amount of capital needed to actually even go and build above the line advertising. But despite that, over a decade, we kind of invented the playbook of just leveraging content marketing through viral videos, along with a great product to live up to, you know, what we are promising, delivering onto that. And I think those, in hindsight, still remain like the difficult things to crack, right? I think having money to spend on paid marketing is an easier problem to solve, right? Once you have the money, you go to Google, Facebook and start spending, or print and TV will be very happy to take money and give you ad space. But I think that's something which is not going to actually set you apart. It will help you amplify what's already working. So I'm not against paid marketing per se. I think it's a great way to amplify organic. But if you don't have organic, you shouldn't spend on paid. It's a wasted spend.
Got it. Fair enough. That makes sense. For the next question, you know, I was wondering, this is going to sound like ChatGPT, but since we have the advantage of having you here, if I had to ask you, how does India travel, considering that, you know, you've compounded these years of data and understood how what customer insights mean, it'll be lovely to know. So how does India travel? What are the insights there?
See, I think India is a very heterogeneous kind of market, right? There is no homogeneity. And I still remember in the early days, you know, when we started, there were hardly what 15, 20 million internet users back in those days. And most of those people were on desktop. Obviously, there was no mobile at that time. All of them were on desktop. And these were the affluent class. So it was natural in those days for all the OTAs to just copy the Western template and launch with flights and hotels. But if you look at the data on how India travels, right?
Yeah.
25 million people every day, you know, use trains in our country to travel. Only about 400,000, 450,000 people travel on a flight every day, right? So the order of magnitude of lives you can impact in the travel category when you operate in things like trains and buses, is multifold bigger than just catering for flights and hotels. And this insight came to us very early, right? Once we saw mobile taking off, we saw where are these mobile consumers coming from. And they were coming from the smallest of towns. And once Jio came in, you could see tier 3, tier 4 taking off, right? People coming from villages with cheap smartphones. And you're like, you know, I'll not be able to sell, obviously, flights to these users.
Yeah.
We have to focus on getting them. And for them, you know, if you go and ask them what travel means, right, they'll say getting on a train and going maybe for a pilgrimage with their parents to, you know, Varanasi or Shirdi or what have you, right? And for them, naturally, travel means getting on a train, right? Like, and the moment we had this insight, and this was 2011-12, right? That's when we started working on what can we do on the train category. So I think I think for a large part of India, the next 10 to 20 year journey is going to be unreserved train travelers starting to book, you know, reserved non-AC train tickets, getting into sleeper class. The sleeper class guy with their incomes increasing, aspirationally moving into third AC and second AC categories, and the third AC and second AC folks being able to afford flight tickets. That's how entire travel category is going to grow. And I think we've just been fortunate to catch him early, right? Like basically, you know, almost 10% of reserved tickets booked in India are being booked through us on the train side. Buses as well, we have a double-digit market share on all the online bus tickets booked, right? So I think we are catching those consumers from tier 2-3 towns whom we call next billion users very early in that life cycle. And then over time, we are able to cross-sell, upsell into other categories as they evolve, as their per capita income purchasing power improves. So the way we look at India is we are still very early. If you look at China or the US, the disposable income that's being spent on travel is in some cases, you know, almost 10-15% of your wallet share, right, of your total income. For the affluent class in India, it might be the same. 15% may be being spent on travel and tourism. But for a lot of India, travel is more a utility use case, right? Getting from point A to point B. And for us, you know, even social gatherings, marriages, pilgrimage, right? These are reasons for travel in Bharat, right? And the moment you look at the lens like that, it just opens up a new market segment, right? That's what it did for us.
Awesome. No, perfect. That's lovely to know. And I think that's, you know, very insightful to know that 50x the number of people who like travel via train vis-a-vis flight. And so focusing on that market is the more intuitive choice just for business purposes as well, not for like just value creation, which is noble in nature. But super interesting. What I want to understand further is, you know, they say that you have to be a user of your own product. You have to be obsessed by your own space. What are your thoughts around travel? Like as an individual, were there early experiments you did to try out the product, go to train stations, understand how this intuitively works? Because like any other consumer product, this feels like something that is natural, right? We are all used to travel, so we'll have natural insights, which means you have natural insights. Yet to build a business, you need more distilled insights, right? Which are
absolutely
on ground.
So I think we were very fortunate that both Rajneesh and I are from smaller towns. Like I grew up in Kanpur and Lucknow. Rajneesh is from Patna and he's lived in even smaller towns in Bihar. We spent our childhoods traveling on buses and trains, right? Till date, every year, I take at least 2-3 train trips, right? Just for the fun of it, because I believe you have more interesting conversations sitting in a train third AC coach than you do on a flight. I mean, if you get to have a conversation on a flight at all. Right? And I think you get to see the countryside, you get to, you know, see a lot more of life as it happens, right, in a train journey. And you're living in the moment, right, unlike, you know, on flights you're done in an hour, so obviously, or 2 hours at max. So I think... just that early exposure as a kid to traveling on these modes really helped in thinking of how, and a lot of our relatives are still back in tier 2-3 towns. And so, you know, you do get that input as a founder. But consciously, we tell our team to actually go and spend time at the railway station, go and sit in a train, you know, take a trip, talk to people to understand what do they really want beyond just, you know, the ticket itself, right? And solve for some of those use cases. And I think the only way over time to build empathy is to continue having that two-way conversation. Like whether it's a angry customer who writes into you and you pick up the phone and call them and understand their pain in real time, or whether it is somebody praising a new feature you launched, right? I mean, those things are important for a founder and leadership to appreciate every day. I'll tell you a small insight there. We have this Slack channel called Customer Happiness. We post all the 1-star and 2-star reviews on that. And apart from our general channel, right, that's the other channel where everybody in the team needs to be on. So everyone in the entire company needs to read every 1-star, 2-star reviews, because how do you build empathy? And empathy is a core cultural value. The way it manifests is you need to build empathy for the pain your customer is experiencing, right? Mm. So if you believe you're perfect, you're never going to solve your problem. So so I think we go that deep when we think about experience.
That's lovely. Very, very interesting. Awesome. Why don't we go and understand this other bit, right? Like when it comes to building a company, the other important bit, and you've always emphasized on it, is culture. And culture seems like this, you know, behavior trait that is unsaid in the organization, but a lot of great founders are very deliberate about it. Talk to us about what it means for you, and over the evolution of the company, what have you done differently to shape culture such that it's percolated through the organization? Because it's one thing for it to be in your head vis-a-vis like have it within 500 people who are working towards this combined mission. So how have you navigated this piece?
I think the most conscious thing you can do about it as a founder is live up to the cultural values you expect to build in your company yourself, right? It needs immense amount of self-control and sacrifice to do that. Mm-hmm. And again, some small examples I can quote is like, I mean, when COVID arrived, the day our PM announced the lockdown, that was 9 p.m. on 25th March, if I remember correctly, I think that afternoon we had already done a virtual town hall where we had talked about what's coming because everybody could sense it by then. And the fact that if it lasted beyond a certain period of time, we would go bust, right? And therefore, we need to figure out what we do about it. There was unanimity. And before that, we'd taken inputs from our leadership team as to, you know, what's the best way to get out of this. There was unanimity in the room about the fact that we should not let go anyone, because nobody knew what this virus was all about. Nobody knew how long this would last. And, you know, the last thing you want in a humanitarian crisis is to leave someone in the lurch without a job, without money, etc., to deal with what's coming next, right? So more than saving the company, it's about saving people at that time. And I think this small action could only be taken if we would be the first ones to say, like the founders were the first ones to say, that we would not draw a single penny of salary till the day we restored everybody's salaries in case we are doing salary cuts, right? And the leadership team also has to double down on that pain and take deep salary cuts, because you know you know that there are people who have to pay rent and meet rent, and you want them to at least have enough to kind of survive.
Yeah.
So if you're taking a tough decision of not letting anyone go, it also has to be backed by sacrifice of saying, what are we willing to lose? Clearly, we don't want to lose the whole company, but we are willing to lose something personally for some period of time. And obviously, we compensated everyone by ESOPs, saying that, you know, in case everything works out, you know, hopefully our company value goes up and you're going to be a part of that as well. And for most of them, it actually worked out very well as a result of that sacrifice they did. But I think going back in time, it was important to say that you feel that pain that people are going through. You're willing to go out of your way to solve for it. Writing empathy on a culture poster won't mean anything, but doing these things is how you demonstrate that, yeah. Right? Another example. COVID was the first time where payment gateways, especially when it comes to travel, were seeing a bigger volume of refunds than collections. Typically, you collect more money, you refund some, right? Cancellations are very small. But here it was the opposite. There was no booking, but only cancellations. We started running out of cash on the payment gateway working capital account. And this was a weekend. So you could only fund the account on Monday. the choice was, do you make your customer wait for two more days in COVID, in a lockdown situation,
yeah,
or do you find other ways to refund them?
Yeah.
Again, suggestion from the team, let's all crowdsource our own money into that account. The company account will transfer it back to us on Monday. We collected more than 40 lakh rupees from employees to refund our customers,
wow,
over a weekend instead of making them wait till Monday. Right? So empathy for customers, that's how it manifests itself. So when we put empathy as our top cultural value, the only way you justify it is by living up to it. Right?
Yeah.
So I think culture has to manifest in your actions, in your decision making, in what you're willing to lose to make sure that you live up to it.
Yeah.
Because you have to at times make choices. And if you make a choice that compromises your culture, you are sending signals that it's not important anymore, right? And you don't want to do that.
Absolutely. Those two stories, again, I think they just put things into perspective, right? Otherwise, this looks like a blanket statement, which may not mean a lot. But I think that just goes to show what true culture really means. Thanks for sharing that, Alok. I think very, very important to note. Go on further, I'd love to understand the other aspect of like just building a fundamentally strong company. And I feel one of those pillars can be focus. And for a company such as yours, I'm sure there are a lot of deviations over business cycles, over market trends, over things like, you know, what's hot, what's new, what's trending. How do you as a company stay true to what's core to what you want to do, while at the same time be open to innovation, right? Of course, you don't close doors, but you also don't like open every door or open every fancy thing that comes in the way. So how do you maintain this balance if there is ever a trade-off on this? And more importantly, what is the focus spectrum for you as a founder and as a company?
It's an excellent question, Jivraj. And I think it's a very tough call, especially as you scale, right? And there's something working at the core.
Yeah.
How much bandwidth do you devote to experiments or new things, right? And one thing which is very unique to us, again, we have actually disrupted our core several times, right? We went from Meta to OTA, from web to app to, you know, from flight to train and, you know, whatnot. There's many transitions we can talk about. But I think what's common across all this is we were never shy of doing experiments. And even some of our video marketing, et cetera, it was all experiments. Some of them worked. And, you know, we were never shy of allowing people to do experiments, right? Where we knew that was a revolving door. If it didn't work, we'd just shut it down, right? But and where it did not take, let's say, years to build that. I mean, if it takes like a month or a few weeks in a hackathon to build something and launch it, why not, right? I think as you grow, obviously, you get a little more risk-averse about these things. But it's very important, especially more so with AI and GPT and all the evolution that you're seeing. In today's world, the time gap to for a new startup to come in and disrupt what you're doing, I think that time and barrier to entry is actually coming down considerably,
right?
Thanks to some of the tools. I think the only moat one ends up having over time is the data and the user base that you end up building. But just building the product or tech itself is obviously going to have smaller and smaller cycles.
Yeah.
So the only way to ensure you're relevant a decade from now is to think of what would disrupt you and do it yourself. Like, so that's the way we tell our team that, you know, if you don't take out some time, and there are many ways we do this. We have hackathons, we have hack weeks, where it's greenfield, you know, people can build whatever they like. And obviously people vote for ideas that get built, but we have come up with several of our innovations during these hack weeks. We also do time to time, you know, like experiments where somebody's excited about something and we're like, okay, why don't you build it? And I think that's the only thing that has helped us stay where we are.
Got it. Very interesting. I think that last part, especially where you have to like understand what can disrupt you and do it yourself, that's a very core trait for any company who wants to like just be relevant across decades, right? the other aspects around being fundamental, and you know, this is all the more relevant, and I'm sure there's so much noise around profitability, sustainability, unit economics. I think thankfully by design or by chance, you can tell us more. You as a company have always exhibited this, right? And this is something that you've spoken across cycles. This is not new for you. I was in fact going through some older interviews, and this is something you were championing in 2012, 2015, 2018, whatnot. Talk to us about what that DNA looks like, right? And where in this venture world was that DNA lost, if at all, from a macro lens? And how have you as a company established that on a very granular level as well? Like, how does this DNA emerge? Where do you think it gets then transferred? And what on a macro level do you have to say about how the ecosystem is shaping up?
Right. So, actually, I was talking about cockroaches back in 2015-16, and at that time, not too many people picked it up, but you know, it's again become very relevant in the last 1 year, and you know, I get invited to conferences to speak about cockroaches versus unicorns. I think, fundamentally, I don't subscribe to the theory where people say that, you know, because the environment around you is changing, you start building your company differently. I think that's a very reactive way to build a company.
Right.
So the best companies out there have continued operating the same way, no matter what the external environment is doing. Yes, of course, you need to do course correction at times, like when you're forced to, you're up against the wall, you need to do something to survive, like we did during COVID, etc. But if you look at the core fundamentals of where we allocate capital, what we believe is the right use of you know, marketing dollars or product dollars, etc. I think that hasn't changed over time. Like, I can't think of, right from day one, right? I can't think of a year where our contribution margin on a booking was ever negative, right? Like, on a blended basis, we've never lost money on what we are selling. So we'll not buy at $100 and sell at $80, right? That doesn't make any sense to us. And it's just one of those principles saying, principally, we'll never do it. Right. Yeah. Like, does it mean we'll not grow fast enough sometimes? Maybe yes. Right. There might be competitors doing it during a certain year, going crazy and bonkers with discounts, etc. on certain categories. I won't name folks, but, you know, there are companies that have done that. And then they either went bust or they, you know, had to, you know, obviously their journey is not what they expected it to be, right, over time, because those things are temporary. You know, you can have this phase of discount funded growth for a year or two, and then you run out of the tap runs dry, you're forced to sell your company, you know, all those things happen. We just consciously said we're not going to get into those kind of discounting wars ever, right?
Yeah.
So we don't get distracted if our team comes back and says company XYZ is doing that. We're like, you know, focus on what we're doing, focus on our customers. If our customers can get delighted by building something, you know, let's work towards that. So that's principle number one. It's just a principle that we've not ever changed, right? That has helped us to get to profitability for sure. The second was, how conscious are you on expanding in the times where you actually have capital, right? I think the bigger mistakes are made when you have access to more capital. You end up misallocating and you end up spending on things that don't make any sense. We've also made those mistakes in our early days, right? In our, after our seed round, and we did spend on paid marketing, although we discovered very quickly that, you know, like, you have to do it very consciously, because it's a it can actually eat up anything that you feed it.
Yeah.
And I think building that consciousness on not throwing people at problems. So if someone comes and says, I need 10 more people in my team, you know, just not saying okay and going ahead just because, but actually going into why is it actually needed, right? And can you do it two or one? And nowadays, can you use ChatGPT and do it with one, right? So I think it's very important to have that mindset, right? Yes, you can do the same thing with 100 people, but and it's harder to do it with just 10.
Yeah.
But it's more sustainable to do it with 10,
correct,
right?
Correct.
So the harder things are usually the more sustainable ones. But obviously somebody will have to work harder and solve for it in a more difficult manner. But if you force that regimen within your team, by saying no, right, at times, and that's what we've done. I mean, you can call it frugality, you can call it like being capital efficient, but it builds that DNA over time where everybody in your team will then start looking at it through that lens, right? So
absolutely.
We have just, and I think you said, you know, what is the ecosystem done wrong, and you know, where are, I just feel that, you know, having access to a lot of capital is one thing, but spending it on things that make no sense, especially if you don't have enough product market fit or you don't have great NPS and you continue to acquire customers, I think those things backfire more than people imagine, right? So discipline in the times of excess is far more important than people think about it.
Absolutely. A lot of interesting pointers there, right? I think access to easy capital can become one of those bad actors in an ecosystem. And just, I think Naval has this graph, right, in the book, which is easy choices now, hard choices now, easy life, hard choices later, easy choices now, hard life later. But very, very interesting to note this. And I think resonating with all pointers, I've had the pleasure of sitting across so many founders who have built sustainable businesses and reiterating this point, because it goes to show that founders have to be just efficient capital deployers also. I don't think that is a spoken enough trait for founders, but that again boils down to a lot of interesting things that founders end up doing. Great, I think this covers a bunch of things that I had in mind. One of the other aspects, right, is this, when you speak about like fundamentals, there is unit economics, there's culture. What are other pillars that are counterintuitive when founders look at company building, or that are behind the scenes of making a business happen? If you can maybe share that from your lens, what are we missing to say that in the context of things, these are also important, may not be front-facing functions, but necessarily important on the back end?
Yeah, so I think encouraging more ownership at every level, you know, as your org scales, right? Like, because I've noticed this, like, it's a very Indian thing, but we end up building top-down orgs in this country, right? Where, you know, everybody seems to be eventually working for their boss. And I think in the best organizations, people work for the cause and not for the boss, right? So I think building that consciously, you know, and that might mean, you know, not giving too much weightage to hierarchy, titles, etc. You know, making sure people know what metrics they are chasing. I think that brings a lot of discipline over time. And we discovered these the hard way, you know, over time after making mistakes and not doing them in our early phase. But, you know, but I think there is incremental value as you grow to align the team better by reminding everybody, you know, what they're really chasing as an end goal and how their actions in their team or their project can really impact that larger goal out there, right? Yeah. Because that alignment as you scale is the difficult part.
Got it. Ownership as a trait and using that as a leverage for the future.
Yeah.
Awesome. When it comes to, Alok, business cycles, right? You've seen a bunch of them now, and good or bad, they keep coming. How do you think founders need to fall back on in terms of just internal motivations versus external motivations to start companies? That is for, you know, wantpreneurs who want to become founders in the future. And for current founders, right? Like, how do you suggest you develop foresight? Because the first time it hit, it feels like a surprise, but business cycles as an economic function have always existed. So, I mean, for somebody who's seen and navigated multiple of them, where do you think the delta lies, right? What can you do beforehand as a founder?
I think reacting quickly and being able to digest that the cycle trend has now changed, right? Like the earlier you realize that and the earlier you course correct if you have made some mistakes in the past, right? I've seen the best founders actually being able to course correct fast enough to then, get out of it in a way that does not lead to long-term harm to the DNA of their companies, right? Because the longer you wait, and again, you know, I won't name companies, but there are people who are doing several rounds of firing in the last 1 year, right? I mean, maybe at some point, you know, layoffs did make sense, but then do it at once, please, right? Like the last thing you want to do is go into that debt spiral where the remaining people also lose their motivation, right, to get you out of that situation because they don't know if they are the next on the list. So I think avoiding classical mistakes like that, which every cycle, every investor sends a deck to their company that tells them to avoid these mistakes, and we end up making the same mistakes in every cycle. That's puzzling, right? And I think we've seen now, like, this is probably like the third or fourth cycle we are seeing. But, I beyond a point, you figure out that, look, if you're true to the cause, right, as a team, as a company, you will find ways to react by looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, this ain't right. Like, we have to go back and do something about it. But if you're chasing, chasing a metric that makes no sense, right? I mean, and actually just chasing valuation blindly sometimes leads to that, right? Mm-hmm. You will not be able to swallow the bitter pill and move on, right? Like, there are companies where, there could have been better outcomes if people chose to, do a down round, flat round fast enough or cut faster and move on, right? But I think people just waited in the hope that something good will happen. And, unfortunately, the environment had changed, right? Yeah. So I think being able to realize that the business cycle has changed, and if you have flab or if you have things that you need to cut back on, do it fast, right? And do it in a way that doesn't harm the long-term DNA in the company, right? Because, if you get out of it, you still need that DNA to grow, right?
Yeah.
So that's the hard part. I mean, I'm sitting here on the other side because thankfully, we were able to do the right things at the right time.
Yeah.
But my advice always is the faster you do it, and if you do it in one go, whatever is needed to fix it permanently, whatever mistakes you made in the past, just do it right now and get done with, right?
Yeah.
The more you elongate it, the more the cultural and DNA damage.
Yeah. Fair enough. Do you as a founder have to build some sort of Zen state to not getting impacted by cycles at all? Or do you have to figure it out in the moment? Is that ideally even possible?
See, all it does is that if you've seen enough cycles, you know what level of reaction you need to have at
what time?
With what you're seeing. Although every cycle is different, COVID was very different. We were not prepared for this at all. And this will not be the last cycle. We also keep telling our folks that, even though travel is bouncing back very well right now, there will be another cycle. And, usually it's like 5 to 7 years.
Right.
Give or take, right? So we know mentally that there will be another one. But before it comes, can we fix those things in the business that need fixing? Can we improve, our profitability? I mean, we are profitable, but we want to be more profitable by the time, the next cycle arrives. So I think just keeping in mind what got you here, and continuing to work on the good things, improving the things that didn't work. Don't lose that momentum ever, despite the cycle, right? Because one thing is certain, like if you're chasing value creation for the customer, it's very unlikely you'll ever go out of business.
Right.
But if you're chasing only valuation, it's actually more likely that you might go out of business, right?
Absolutely. Now that I think sums it up really well. As we talk about, enduring companies, sustainability, fundamentals, I think the question that I mean, so eventually the North Star becomes becoming a public company, right? Every entrepreneur aspires to be that. And I'm sure that will someday happen to your company as well. What I want to understand is that fundamentally it seems like the characteristics required to build a venture-backed company vis-a-vis a public company are almost diametrically opposite, which is to say that an IPO'd company will require, you know, some sort of predictability, some sort of understanding that, okay, this is going to happen when, stuff like that. Vis-a-vis, there'll be a lot of experiments, not predictable growth, all of that in a venture-backed company through its life cycle. How does this, and somebody who's seen the ecosystem from inside it for the last, like, 1.5 decades, what do you think are, you know, what is the mismatch here, if at all there is one?
I think we are sitting at a fortunate position where we are kind of straddling the two sides right now. Like, we've filed for going public already, and at the same time, we've gone through the private fundraise cycles. Although we are not public yet, but we've interacted with public market investors enough to understand that they do want to see two or three things. I mean, one is obviously, like you said, they want to see predictability. They want to see, you know, sustained growth in earnings over time, right? Like, how will you deliver that? They want to see also not too many moving parts, right? Which in early growth stage businesses, there'll always be a lot, right? So I think as a founder, you have to think of whether you've reached a point where your business has fewer moving parts. There is more predictability on how your earnings will grow. Are you starting to show operating leverage come in, right? Whether you're profitable or close to profitability, are you seeing that your contribution margin improvement over time is going to deliver better and better profitability in the next few years? That's probably the right time. And of course, you need a minimum amount of scale to excite the public markets, right? Because you don't want to end up as a small stock that nobody cares about, right? So I think as long as those ingredients are in place, the other ingredient I'll say is like financial discipline. And corporate governance, right? The level of disclosures and corporate governance that public market investors want versus what private market cares about is very different. Financial discipline, closing every quarter, reporting every quarter, I think being answerable, being in front of investors, I think, again, as much as you can be upfront there about what's working, what's not working in those interactions is appreciated by the market. And being able to give the right guidance, those things are. So I think it's a very tough road to go on. But if you want to build a enduring company, it's probably the only outcome that makes sense, that right? Helps. Because I know that if I want to build an institution that lasts beyond me, the only way to do it is by taking the company public at some point, right? That's my motivation or our motivation as founders, you know, to go down that route. But it's a tough route. I mean, if you can stay private for long enough, I recommend you do because, you know, you have more flexibility. You don't have to answer too many questions because you can still, you know, convince just two people, three people, five people that you're on the right track and still continue down that path. There you're answerable to, you know, the thousands of retail investors as well, right? So so you have to become more measured in what you say.
Absolutely.
And what you do, both.
No, interesting choices that one is presented by, but that I'm sure remains to be the North Star for any founder starting a company. And I'm sure in a business like yours, there'll be all the more gratification when customers become shareholders. And hopefully that's going to take place soon. This has been very interesting, Alok. And, you know, as we go to concluding aspects, I have one or two standardized questions that I ask most founders on the show that highlights and humanizes the entrepreneurial journey, because I keep iterating this on the show. The idea is not to make this journey seem aspirational. It is to make it more achievable, if at all this is a pathway that you aspire to achieve. One of the things there is, as a, you know, IIT grad, as an INSEAD grad, I'm sure you've seen a lot of the world. But post that, you started building a company and you've now built that over 16 years. if you had to maybe qualitatively tell us how you have grown and scaled, because we can look at Ixigo and be like, okay, there's this tangible, okay, zero say, this is the valuation, this is the number of customers, whatnot, and we can put a number to it. Very hard to quantify individual growth, but I'm sure that's the one that counts the most because that's what contributes to the value creation. So if you can maybe tell us, looking back, how you have personally scaled, grown qualitatively, I think that'd be very helpful.
Yeah, so I think it has brought a lot more humility. As a young founder, you want to change the world and you have huge aspirations and you think you can do everything. But over time, you discover your limitations, right? And I think it's not wrong to have very big aspirations. It's actually very important to have extremely big aspirations, but it's also important to be pragmatic and to be humble enough to take feedback, rejections, etc., in the right spirit. So I think that's where some of the struggles actually help, because they make you look in the mirror and you kind of don't take things for granted anymore, and you start indexing for the right things, right? So I in that way, I think being capital starved in the early days or being rejected by multiple investors in the early days was a blessing, right? Yeah. Because it helped us become more grounded and more humble in terms of how we thought about ourselves and the business. And it also allowed us to then go back and just focus on the fundamentals, right? Because that was the only thing that was working. So might as well double down on that. So I think that has made me more grounded, more humble. I get less carried away by flashy, fancy things than I used to back when I started. I think the other thing is, like, we over-index for degrees and even experience, right? In the early days, you get more carried away by those things. But over time, you discover that the best people in your system are the people who came for the hunger and passion that they had, right? Yeah. Skills are transferable. Skills are, can be acquired over time if somebody is eager enough, passionate enough. But it's harder to ignite that passion inorganically. You cannot do that. Even the most experienced, most skilled people, if they're not passionate, they fail to deliver. So I think that learning has also come over time. I don't think we were so good at identifying that in the early days. And, hopefully we've gotten better at that now. And the last thing is just setting the right expectations from all the stakeholders, basically, whether it's investors, board members, internal stakeholders, setting the right expectations and trying to, underpromise, over-deliver. Because when you're obviously a young founder, you make very aggressive plans. And even if you fail to achieve them, you still build a large company at the end of it. But as you mature, as you grow, I think making the, what you communicate, you need to deliver on, right?
Yeah.
That builds your credibility. That builds trust, right? And hopefully we've gone better at that over the last few years, right? As we became bigger, also things become more predictable.
Yeah.
I think that's where the maturity has come from.
Lovely. I think those are very in-depth pointers to note, right? Humility and how you speak about just setting the right ambitions and understanding that this journey is not what it seems like from the outside, living it and then believing it in a different way.
And if I had to add just one more thing, if you allow me.
Please.
I think you also discovered the true motivations of why you started along the way, right? Because initially, you will have multiple motivations. You want to build something. You want to change the world. You want to, obviously solve the pain areas for the kind of customer sets you're building for. And you also want to capture the value over time yourselves, because, everyone aspires to also have financial freedom and financial gain, right? But over time, you start realizing what matters more, right? And I think there's just the satisfaction today of serving millions of Indians in their travel-related informational needs or utility needs or booking needs, right? And then being able to have like more than 500 people join you in that process of delivering that every day, right? I think that starts giving you more satisfaction than all other things combined, right?
Yeah.
So I think over time you discover that some of the things that I think money is the easier thing to solve for, and the harder things, the more valuable things to solve for, actually start meaning a lot more to you, right? Yeah. And that's where you start focusing most of your time and attention. So whether it's people, keeping people happy, keeping customers happy, you know, that's where most of my time goes into.
Yeah. And that's lovely to mention. I think important to note the true motivations behind starting a company, and the journey represents it more than anything else, right? So very important to echo that. Thanks for mentioning. I think the other bit is, you know, we as humans manifest the best through stories. On a very general level, if I had to ask you some 2-3 memories, okay, be it, you know, milestones, could be key levers to the journey, or just like bad times also when people just stuck around, what would those 2-3 instances be if you could narrate? You've already told us a bunch, but I think this would be interesting.
Yeah, so I think the earliest story is back in 2008. So if I rewind to 2007, when we launched, we'd gone to almost all the, you know, early stage guys, got rejected by most of them. And then we found, I mean, the anecdote of how we raised our seed round is also very interesting. So we got a phone call on the, we had a physical phone those days in our office, right. Just one. And we got a phone call there where I picked up the phone, and the person at the other end of the line says, Can I speak to the CEO, the founder? And I'm like, I'm the co-founder and CEO, yes. Yeah. So, and then he says, you know, I really like your product. I've been playing around with it, and I'm an investor based in Singapore. Can you come down and meet me, right? I want you to pitch to the group. And that's how our seed round happened. Literally flew down there and came back, got a term sheet, right? But post that, we started getting inbound from all those investors who said no. You know, there's a lot of herd mentality, as we all know, right? And we were very close to, in fact, we had a term sheet, diligence, etc. We were very close to getting money in the bank when Lehman Brothers happened you know, things collapsed. And I think at that moment, we were like hardly like a 25-member team and a very small office. We all went into... We had only one meeting room. Everybody in that meeting room told them this is the situation. And we'd increased our burn rate already because we had millions of dollars coming into the bank in our mind. And one young engineer who was probably, 2 years out of college, right? Like, stands up and says that, you know, it's an easy problem to solve. We can all just go without any salary, right? Like for the next 12 months and solve. Because our revenue is growing slowly. You know, we'll get there. It just changed the sentiment in the room because it was this serious mood where people were like, oh shit, you know, company is gonna go bust. And then it was like, oh no, we can save it, right? And that moment was game changing, right? Like that moment brought us all together. We did our P&L on the board and actually found a way to survive, where everybody took like some salary cut, obviously not 100%, but over time, you know, we actually got the company to break even on the other side. By 2010, we reached, before our Series A round, we had a quarter of break even, right? So I think those kind of moments actually were defining moments in the journey, right? COVID, we already talked about. There was this other moment where we were closing a round and, you know, like ran out of cash again because didn't know how to pay the next month's salary. The round could take another month, who knows, right? And Rajneesh and I had to mortgage our assets, put in money into the company, right? Just to pay the salary. Nobody knew this. I mean, probably not talked much about this till date, but we did salaries on first, like we always did. Nobody knew what was happening, and but it was our personal money on the line. So we've had these moments, and I think every founder out there would have had these moments, because the last thing, and you don't share these moments with everyone, right?
Yeah. And that's very I think very commendable to hear. I can only imagine. I can't know the depth of what that means, but I can only imagine what it means to go through that and then be on this side. I am sure it's a huge moment of gratification, but thanks for sharing. I think it puts a lot of things into perspective about just building a company. As we end, right, I think we've covered a bunch of things, Alok. For the end, I think it'll be helpful to just note personal values and just compass systems that, you know, inspire you and drive you. Because, I mean, in the little I've got the opportunity to observe just before this as well, I observed this, you know, depth and just a passion to go deep into something, understand it in, like, relatively great terms and talk about it with like incredible passion. And similarly, through the company building journey in the public domain that I've observed you, you're really passionate about things. What's next? Things like AI, right? And you are well understood and thinking about them all the time, positively obsessed. Talk about some of these elements and how you maybe manifested them through the building journey of Ixigo. And I think that'll be a great concludery aspect.
No, so I think I've been very nerdy, right, from college days, right? Like, I did an electrical engineering degree, but the place where you would look for me if I was not found on campus was in the computer center, because I'd be sitting and coding or just hacking away, you know, at something. And this was back in 97, 98, early days of the internet I'm talking about, right? So, so I've been very close to technology in my heart, you know, all the time. Love playing with new stuff, gadgets, etc. And I think just staying abreast with the bleeding edge is something which both Rajneesh, my co-founder, who's obviously far deeper into it than I am, because he's the guy who's actually in the action. But even at my level, like, I try to remain in touch with all that's happening around. Try to follow the right people, to listen to their voices, listen to the right podcasts as well to stay in touch. But I think that's something that feeds into my energy. And then obviously making sure that your team also is open to, you know, new ideas and new thinking. And AI being the most latest thing. I mean, people have started talking about it now, but we've been, like, we have several AI use cases live now for the last 8-9 years, right? Like, the train running status prediction we've built, the PNR prediction we've built, the Tara AI chatbot that we built, these have been around live for several years based on machine learning and AI use cases, right? I think you have to build a culture where everyone in your team sort of is not just aware about what's happening out there, but also trying these things out, right? I mean, we do encourage people to try out the latest apps that come around, whether it's a very small startup, whether it's launched something, because it feeds into your, you know, your creativity. And it also constantly reminds you that, you know, you have to disrupt yourself. Yeah. You have to leverage those in some way or the other.
Absolutely.
Learn from it, try it out. So I think that DNA has been within me, my co-founder, and, you know, we've tried to give it to the whole team. Just so you know, like, probably most people in our team are already using ChatGPT for something or the other, right? Like, because we know the potential of that technology. But I think the biggest value that has kept me grounded is just constantly reminding myself that, you know, ultimately what we leave behind as a legacy is how we treated people around us, right? And those people could be your family, your friends, your team, your customers. They're all like individuals and people, right? So and that's something I got from my dad, right? Who's a very spiritual person, and you know, we come from a family where spiritualism and religion has been very important. And I think some of that manifests itself in how we operate today. Yeah.
Got it. Amazing. I think this has been a very wonderful chat. We've covered aspects around your personal thinking, how you've built Ixigo, and the aspects around culture, enduring companies, business cycles, and just feels like a very long ambit of things that we've covered in a very condensed, interesting form. Thank you so much, Alok, for being on the show. It's been such a pleasure hosting you and knowing your journey more. I'm sure this is going to be very helpful for everyone listening. And thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me. And it was a pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you.